This is the Clinical Pharmacology Podcast with Nathan Tuescher, where I discuss clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics topics from the perspective of drug development scientists. Hi, everyone. I hope you're having a wonderful start to your fall season in the Northern Hemisphere, or to your spring season if you live in the Southern Hemisphere. Thank you for your feedback on the last episode about finding a job in clinical pharmacology, pharmacometrics, or DMPK. If you're looking for a job, I recommend that you get in touch with a recruiter like TJ to assist in your search. TJ shared so many great insights in our conversation that it can help you find your perfect position. In today's episode, we're going to discuss another regulatory guidance. Today's topic is based on the April 2003 guidance from the US FDA titled Exposure-Response Relationships, Study Design, Data Analysis, and Regulatory Applications. You can find a link to the guidance document in the show notes. This guidance was a joint effort of both CDER and CBER, which represent both the drug and biologic review divisions of the FDA. I think this is an underappreciated guidance document within our discipline of clinical pharmacology, and I think a few lines from the background section of the guidance document summarize why we should pay attention to the contents of this document. Quote, exposure response is at the heart of any determination of the safety and effectiveness of drugs. That is, a drug can be determined to be safe and effective only when the relationship of beneficial and adverse effects to a defined exposure is known. Close quote. I believe clinical pharmacology experts and pharmacometricians can and should play a key role in developing, analyzing, and explaining exposure response information to aid in the determination of the safety and effectiveness of the drugs we are developing. This guidance document on exposure response relationships was released over 20 years ago and is an update to the November 1994 ICH E4 guideline on dose response information. Thus, over the past 20 to 30 years, no new guidance documents have been released on this topic. However, in my opinion, regulatory bodies are only now leveraging the power of these guidances to help evaluate the safety and effectiveness of drug products. When I started my career in pharmaceutical development, exposure response analyses were generally not considered necessary unless there was a deficiency in the safety or efficacy data from the phase 3 program. However, today, exposure response analyses are necessary in nearly all drug approval packages. The FDA guidance document delivers an accurate but disappointing statement of how drug developers have tended to view exposure response information. I'll paraphrase what it says. Drug developers have done a nice job of establishing a relationship between the administered dose and blood concentrations, including rationale for dose adjustments for specific patient subgroups based on demographics, disease state, or other variables, but far less attention has been spent establishing a relationship between blood concentrations and pharmacodynamic responses, and differences in these concentration-response relationships. These concentration-response relationships can be critical to the assessment of safety and effectiveness of a drug. So today, let's talk about these exposure-response relationships and how you can start to change the perception that we are ignoring the concentration-response relationship. This episode will be divided into four separate sections, followed by a summary at the end. The first section will discuss how exposure-response information can be used for regulatory applications. The second section will discuss the exposure-response relationships themselves. The third section will discuss the design of studies in which you plan on collecting exposure response information, and the fourth section will discuss modeling exposure response relationships. While I generally follow the recommendations of the guidance document, I'll include my own thoughts and experiences throughout the podcast. The regulatory applications outlined for exposure response analyses in the guidance are very broad and can be an enormous aid in drug development. There are three key applications enumerated. First, a well-controlled exposure-response clinical study can contribute substantial evidence of effectiveness. Second, exposure-response analyses can add to the weight of evidence supporting efficacy. Third, exposure-response analyses can support, or in some cases provide primary evidence for approval of different doses, dosing regimens, dosage forms, or even use of a drug in a different population. These applications can be a massive advantage during drug development. This means you can use exposure response studies and data to support approvals of dose levels you didn't study in phase 3, or perhaps a new dosage form such as an extended release formulation, or even use of the drug in a population where you have yet to conduct clinical studies. These are very powerful options that can drastically shorten development cycles, save costs by not running expensive clinical studies, and help refine a drug label as new information is acquired. I have personally seen regulators leverage all three of these applications in the approval process during my career. And I have seen approval of dose levels, dosing regimens, and formulations never tested for safety and effectiveness, based only upon exposure response analyses. The guidance document includes more detailed recommendations for each of these three applications, which you should read and review. Leveraging opportunities to use exposure response analyses can be extremely beneficial to your organization. Exposure response relationships are inherently more complicated than dose concentration relationships. This is true simply because the exposure response relationship includes additional biological processes, and there may be a significant delay between the time of the exposure measurement and the time of the response signal. The first thing to describe is what is meant by the word exposure. Broadly defined, exposure refers to any measure of the amount of drug either administered or circulating in the body. Some common measures of exposure are the administered dose, the maximum concentration or Cmax, the minimum concentration or Cmin, and the area under the curve or AUC. For most chronic treatments, these values are assessed at steady state over the planned dosing interval. Exposure can also refer to the entire concentration time profile, as would be expected with a PK/PD model. The response refers to a direct measure of the pharmacologic, positive or negative, effect of the drug. These can be biomarkers such as receptor occupancy, enzyme inhibition, blood pressure, lipid levels, or cardiac output. Or they can be endpoints such as responder status, presence or absence of an adverse event, or grade or severity of an event. Thus, response variables can be continuous, ordered categorical, binary, time to event, or even multiple time to event. The most common method for measuring exposure response is to evaluate differences in exposure and response between different treatment groups at steady state. This ignores fluctuation in response over time, but is able to evaluate how different levels of exposure may or may not impact response. If the response you are measuring is not expected to change with the time of treatment, this may be a good option for your analysis. But if your drug has effects such as induction, tolerance, or other time dependency, a steady state analysis may not be optimal. In these cases, it is imperative that you measure the response over time to allow you to identify the time dependencies. The most common method for assessing the concentration response is to compare the observed concentrations with the observed responses for a group of study participants who receive different doses of a drug. In these studies, participants are randomized to different dose groups, and then the observed concentrations and responses are recorded at specific time points. However, even when a study like this is well designed, properly conducted, and even correctly analyzed, the results of the concentration response analysis may not accurately reflect the exposure response relationship. Let me give you a couple of examples. The first example is when you have a drug that accumulates over time with multiple doses. If you are evaluating safety events, participants that have no adverse events are more likely to dose longer than participants who experience an adverse event. Thus, participants with fewer doses and lower concentrations will appear to be more likely to have an adverse event than participants with more doses and higher concentrations. This exposure response relationship would suggest that higher concentrations are protective against the adverse event, when in fact what you are seeing is that participants with the adverse event are likely to receive fewer doses, which results in lower observed concentrations. A second example is when the study design calls for within-patient dose escalations. If the efficacy response is not adequate, the dose is increased until an adequate response is achieved. These types of studies where subjects are titrated to an effective dose are very common. But these studies nearly always lead to an upside-down U or bell-shaped exposure response curve. Because non-responders are always titrated to the highest dose allowed in the study, the highest dose will include most or all of those non-responders, which will make it appear as if the highest dose is not effective. The second method for assessing concentration response is not frequently used, but can be easier to interpret. These studies are designed to randomize subjects to a target concentration and not a dose level. These designs are harder to successfully execute because they require frequent PK sampling and then dose adjustments based on a PK model. From an operational perspective, that's not very attractive. But from an analysis perspective, it removes many of the confounding factors that I just noted. The design of an exposure response study can have an impact on the method of analysis and the interpretation of results. There is no single design that is appropriate for all exposure response studies. You must combine what you know about the drug with what you want to learn and then decide on the appropriate study design. The table on page 11 of the guidance is particularly useful when working through this process. Please note that the printed page 11 is not the 11th page in the PDF document. The FDA includes unnumbered pages at the beginning of the PDF file. So page 11 of the document is actually page 14 of the PDF file. Regardless of your study design, you should always take samples to measure concentrations of parent drug and any metabolites that contribute to the response you're measuring. You may take many samples or just a few, depending on your prior knowledge about the pharmacokinetics in this patient population. You can summarize the concentration information through a metric such as Cmax, Cmin, or AUC. This is very useful in analyses with binary or categorical endpoints because you now have a single exposure metric to compare with a single endpoint. If you do not take any concentration samples in the study where you measured response, you will have a difficult time building a quality exposure response relationship. Even if you have an existing population PK model for the drug, you will only be able to predict the typical exposure for a participant with the relevant covariate information. That means that two subjects with the same covariate information will have the same predicted exposure. And if their responses differ, all of that difference will be attributed to variability in the exposure response, which is likely inaccurate. So even if you can only get a single blood sample for concentration determination, it is worth it. If possible, get 1 to 3 samples on at least 2 different study days to accurately estimate the exposure for each participant. Since the purpose of the study is exposure response, you will definitely need to measure the response. The guidance has divided response measurements into 3 categories. First are biomarkers, which are measures thought to be related to the pharmacologic activity of the drug. The term biomarker, from my perspective, is a bit mushy. Basically, anything can be considered a biomarker. Examples in the guidance include blood pressure, cholesterol levels, viral load, brain infarct size, functional test, ex vivo inhibition or receptor binding assays. Biomarkers are useful, but often not considered surrogates for determination of efficacy. Thus, use biomarkers to help in dose selection, study design, and support for mechanism of action. But don't plan on biomarkers to support approval of new dose levels or new patient populations. Second are surrogate endpoints. A surrogate endpoint is a laboratory measure that is accepted in place of a clinical endpoint for a specific disease. A commonly cited example is LDL cholesterol levels as a surrogate for heart disease. Most of the cholesterol-lowering medications were approved based on the surrogate endpoint of lowering LDL levels. However, the true clinical benefit is a reduction in cardiovascular events such as a heart attack. Surrogate endpoints are a very small group of measures that generally require significant data from multiple drug products to support their use. If you're working on a new drug for a new indication, it is likely that you don't have a surrogate endpoint. Third are clinical benefit or outcomes. These are variables that reflect how a patient feels, functions, or survives. These are the endpoints used in phase 3 trials to determine the safety and effectiveness of drugs. Some examples from the safety side could be the occurrence of an adverse event, change in disease severity, and change in a biomarker past a recognized threshold value. Examples from the efficacy side could be participant survival during cancer treatment, achieving remission, changes in disease severity scores, and categorization as a responder using a predefined criterion. Now let's talk about modeling the exposure response data that has been collected. I'll divide my discussion into two types of models: PK/PD models, which use individual concentration data, and exposure response, or ER, models, which use a summary exposure statistic. PK/PD models are less common because they are more complicated to build and generally require more data than ER models. When creating a PK/PD model, the first thing you should do is determine if there is a time shift between the drug concentrations and the response. Meaning, is there a delay between the peak concentration is observed and when the peak effect occurs? The easiest way to evaluate this is by constructing a plot of time-matched concentrations as the X variable and response as the Y variable and looking for hysteresis. Hysteresis occurs when you have two different responses at the same concentration. Visually, the plot will look like an oval shape where there is a space in the middle. This happens because response lags behind the concentration. When concentrations are rising, you get a response that is a bit below what is expected. And when the concentrations are falling, you get a response that is a bit above what is expected. That gives two different response values at the same concentration. If you see hysteresis, then you should implement a PK/PD model that incorporates a time delay. This could be an effect compartment model or an indirect response model. I always recommend plotting individual data rather than mean data for the determination of hysteresis. If no hysteresis is observed, you can use a direct effect PK/PD model to characterize the concentration response information. ER models are much more commonly used than PK/PD models. This is because you have more freedom to use empirical model structures to describe the relationship. And in many cases, you only have a single exposure and single response measure for each subject. For example, in a safety ER analysis, each subject either experienced the target adverse event or did not experience it. So there is only a single binary response for each subject. And normally, we use a single summary statistic like Cmax or AUC at steady state as the exposure metric. In this case, we would use logistic regression to evaluate the relationship between the exposure metric and the probability of experiencing an adverse event. These logistic regression models are very easily analyzed using R. You can fit the models, test for the impact of other predictors such as demographics and baseline laboratory values have on the response, and generate visual predictive checks in a few lines of code. Most of my work on ER analyses leverages these logistic regression models. Nearly all safety analyses use the binary endpoint of occurrence of an adverse event, and many efficacy analyses use a binary endpoint of a responder. This podcast is not a lecture on logistic regression models, but I strongly recommend that you learn about these types of models and how to build them, how to interpret the results, and how to identify issues in these models. One important thing to recognize is that these models test the relative impact of multiple predictors on a single outcome variable. These models do not evaluate covariates in nearly all cases. Covariates are variables of known information about a subject that impact model parameters. Predictors are variables of known information about a subject that impact the prediction or the outcome variable. So please use the word predictor when speaking about logistic regression. Because you are looking at multiple predictors, you could determine which predictors have the largest relative impact on the outcome variable. You can evaluate if sex, race, or baseline values have a larger impact on response than the exposure metric of choice. You can also determine which exposure metric of choice is the strongest predictor of an outcome variable. A second type of ER models are time-to-event models. These models are used when we stop following a participant's progress after an event occurs. In oncology studies, the event could be disease progression or death. In a study of renal function, the event could be initiation of dialysis. Each subject will have a number of days on treatment and then a binary determination of whether the event happened or not. For subjects that did not experience the event, the number of days will be the last day for which we have data on that individual. For subjects that experienced the event, the number of days will be the day of the event. These data are analyzed using time-to-event models, the most common of which is a Kaplan-Meier curve. In this analysis, it's useful to divide the participants into discrete groups, such as exposure quartiles, and compare if the Kaplan-Meier curves are different from one another. If there are differences in the exposure quartiles, then more mechanistic time-to-event modeling can be performed. A third type of ER models are time and exposure-dependent model. These models are similar to PK/PD models, but lack the rigid structure of PK/PD models. For example, the response variable may trend downward over time in placebo patients due to disease progression, while increasing over time in patients that receive drug treatment. In this case, you could envision a response variable that is a function of both time and concentration. One could use linear, Emax, or other more complex models to describe the changes in response with changes in concentration and time. These ER models can be fit quickly and easily in R using a nonlinear mixed effects package. In addition, there is great flexibility in structuring these models in R and not having to worry about the constraints of PK systems and instability in PK/PD models. These types of ER models are very often used in meta-analyses of exposure response across an entire class of compounds in multiple clinical studies, but they can also be used with a single compound and a single study. Whatever type of model you choose to develop, you should ensure that your analysis includes a clear, testable hypothesis, a description of the analysis methodology and any assumptions you make, a clear description of the selected model structure and rationale for using that model compared to other simpler options, diagnostic tables and plots that assess the model assumptions, and predictive properties of the final model. At a minimum, appropriate goodness of fit plots, if possible, and visual predictive checks should accompany a summary of the model parameters. In conclusion, I believe that every application for drug approval should include exposure response analyses for both safety and efficacy. These analyses are critical to aiding the reviewing agency put in context the proposed dose and dosing regimen with the known information about the safety and effectiveness of the drug. The absence of these analyses will only hurt your submission. I know of one submission in which I conducted both the safety and efficacy ER and could not identify a single predictor of any endpoint except drug treatment. The drug was a targeted therapeutic that had a very clean safety profile with very few side effects and spectacular efficacy with nearly 100% response rate within a specific phenotype. Although the analysis results would be considered boring from a scientific perspective, they were noted in the reviewer's response as critical to supporting the selected dose and dosing regimen. I encourage you to read the guidance and then work to implement exposure response analyses in your development programs. If you're unsure how to do that, reach out to a colleague, review the literature, visit a poster session where those analyses are presented, or contact a consultant with expertise. I'm happy to help anybody that would like to do exposure response on their development program, so reach out to me using the links in the show notes. These analyses are essential to your drug development and approval prospects, and the analyses are often not complicated or time-consuming, so they can give you quick and robust answers. That's it for today's episode, a review of the exposure response guidance from the FDA. For more information, please connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email to nathan@tushersolutions.com, or sign up for my newsletter at tushersolutions.com/newsletter. The newsletter is a copy of the show notes sent to your email each time an episode is released. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to the show. Thank you.